Side 19. Now I tell myself, Dr. Arroway, you scientists had the brains to figure all this out, and the motivation, but by yourselves you didn't have the means. If it wasn't the Russians who put up this satellite for you, it could have been any one of half a dozen other national launch authorities. But we've looked into all that. Nobody launched a free-flying satellite in the appropriate orbits. That leaves private launch capability. And the most interesting possibility that's come to our notice is a Mr. S.R. Haddon. Know him? Oh, don't be ridiculous, Michael. I talked to you about Haddon before I went up to Methuselah. Just wanted to be sure we agree on the basics. Try this on for size. You and the Russian concoct this scheme. You get Haddon to bankroll the early stages, the satellite design, the invention of the machine, the encrypting of the message, faking the radiation damage, all that. In return, after the machine project gets going, he gets to play with some of that $2 trillion. Well, he likes the idea. There might be enormous profit in it. And from his history, he'd love to embarrass the government. When you get stuck in decrypting the message, when you can't find the primer, you even go to him. He tells you where to look for it. That was also careless. It would have been better if you figured it out yourself. Always too careless, offered your hear. Wouldn't someone who was really perpetrating a hoax? Ken, I'm surprised at you. You've been very credulous, you know. You're demonstrating exactly why Arroway and the others thought it would be clever to ask Haddon's advice, and to make sure we knew she'd gone to see him. He returned his attention to her. Dr. Arroway, try to look at it from the standpoint of a neutral observer. Kits pressed on, making sparkling new patterns of facts assemble themselves in the air before her, rewriting whole years of her life. She hadn't thought Kits dumb, but she hadn't imagined him this inventive either. Perhaps he had received help, but the emotional propulsion for this fantasy came from Kits. He was full of expansive gestures and rhetorical flourishes. This was not merely part of his job. This interrogation, this alternative interpretation of events, had roused something passionate in him. After a moment, she thought she saw what it was. The Five had come back with no immediate military applications, no political liquid capital, but only a story that was surpassing strange. And that story had certain implications. Kits was now master of the most devastating arsenal on Earth, while the caretakers were building galaxies. He was a lineal descendant of a progression of leaders, American and Soviet, who had devised the strategy of nuclear confrontation, while the caretakers were an amalgam of diverse species from separate worlds working together in concert. Their very existence was an unspoken rebuke. Then consider the possibility that the tunnel could be activated from the other end, that there might be nothing he could do to prevent it. They could be here in an instant. How could Kits defend the United States under such circumstances? His role in the decision to build the machine, the history of which he seemed to be actively rewriting, could be interpreted by an unfriendly tribunal as dereliction of duty. And what account could Kits give the extraterrestrials of his stewardship of the planet, he and his predecessors? Even if no avenging angels came storming out of the tunnel, if the truth of the journey got out, the world would change. It was already changing. It would change much more. Again, she regarded him with sympathy. For 100 generations, at least, the world had been run by people much worse than he. It was his misfortune to come to bat, just as the rules of the game were being rewritten. "Even if you believed every detail of your story," he was saying, "don't you think the extraterrestrials treated you badly? They take advantage of your tenderest feelings by dressing themselves up as dear old dad. They don't tell you what they're doing. They expose all your film, destroy all your data, and don't even let you leave that stupid palm frond up there. Nothing on the manifest is missing except for a little food, and nothing that isn't on the manifest is returned except for a little sand. So in 20 minutes, you gobbled some food and dumped a little sand out of your pockets. You come back 1 nanosecond or something after you leave, so to any neutral observer, you never left at all. Now, if the extraterrestrials wanted to make it unambiguously clear you'd really gone somewhere, they would have brought you back a day later. Or a week, right? If there was nothing inside the Benzels for a while, we'd be dead certain that you'd gone somewhere. If they wanted to make it easy for you, they wouldn't have turned off the message, right? That makes it look bad, you know. They could have figured that out. Why would they want to make it bad for you? And there's other ways they could have supported your story. They could have given you something to remember them by. They could have let you bring back your movies. Then nobody could claim all this is just a clever fake. So how come they didn't do that? How come the extraterrestrials don't confirm your story? You spent years of your life trying to find them. Don't they appreciate what you've done? Ellie, how can you be so sure your story really happened? If, as you claim, all this isn't a hoax, couldn't it be a delusion? It's painful to consider, I know. Nobody wants to think they've gone a little crazy. Considering the strain you've been under, though, it's no big deal. And if the only alternative is criminal conspiracy, maybe you want to carefully think this one through. She had already done so. Later that day, she met with Kitts alone. A bargain had, in effect, been proposed. She had no intention of going along with it. But Kitts was prepared for that possibility as well. "You never liked me from the first," he said. "But I'm going to rise above that. We're going to do something really fair. We've already issued a news release saying that the machine just didn't work when we tried to activate it. Naturally, we're trying to understand what went wrong. With all the other failures in Wyoming and Uzbekistan, nobody is doubting this one. Then in a few weeks, we'll announce that we're still not getting anywhere. We've done the best we could. The machine is too expensive to keep working on. Probably we're just not smart enough to figure it out yet. Also, there's still some danger, after all. We always knew that. The machine might blow up or something. So all in all, it's best to put the machine project on ice, at least for a while. It's not that we didn't try. Haddon and his friends would oppose it, of course, but as he's been taken from us... He's only 300 kilometers overhead, she pointed out. Oh, haven't you heard? Saul died just around the time the machine was activated. Funny how it happened. Sorry, I should have told you. I forgot you were, close to him. She did not know whether to believe Kitts. Haddon was in his 50s, and it certainly seemed in good physical health. She would pursue this topic later. And what, in your fantasy, becomes of us? She asked. Us? Who's us? Us. The five of us, the ones who went aboard the machine that you claim never worked. Oh. After a little more debriefing, you'll be free to leave. I don't think any of you will be foolish enough to tell this cock-and-bull story on the outside. But just to be safe, we're preparing some psychiatric dossiers on the five of you. Profiles, low-key. You've always been a little rebellious. Mad at the system, whichever system you grew up in. It's okay, it's good for people to be independent. We encourage that, especially in scientists. But the strain of the last few years has been trying. Not actually disabling, but trying. Especially for Doctors Arroway and Lunacharsky. First, they're involved in finding the message, decrypting it, and convincing the governments to build the machine. Then problems in construction. Industrial sabotage. Sitting through an activation that goes nowhere. It's been tough. All work and no play. And scientists are highly strung anyway. If you've all become a little unhinged at the failure of the machine, everybody will be sympathetic, understanding. But nobody will believe your story. Nobody. If you behave yourselves, there's no reason that the dossiers ever have to be released. It'll be clear that the machine is still here. We're having a few wire service photographers in to photograph it as soon as the roads are open. We'll show them the machine didn't go anywhere, and the crew, the crew is naturally disappointed, maybe a little disheartened. They don't want to talk to the press just yet. Don't you think it's a neat plan? He smiled. He wanted her to acknowledge the beauty of the scheme. She said nothing. Don't you think we're being very reasonable after spending $2 trillion on that pile of shit? We could put you away for life, Arroway, but we're letting you go free. You don't even have to put up bail. I think we're behaving like gentlemen. It's the spirit of the millennium. It's Machindo. Chapter 22. Gilgamesh. That it will never come again is what makes life so sweet. Emily Dickinson, poem number 1741. In this time, heralded expansively as the dawn of a new age, Burial in space was an expensive commonplace. Commercially available and a competitive business, it appealed especially to those who, in former times, would have requested that their remains be scattered over the county of their birth, or at least the mill town from which they had extracted their first fortune. But now you could arrange for your remains to circumnavigate the earth forever, or as close to forever as matters in the workaday world. You need only insert a short codicil in your will. Then, assuming, of course, that you have the wherewithal, when you die and are cremated, your ashes are compressed into a tiny, almost toy-like bier, on which is embossed your name and your dates, a short memorial verse, and the religious symbol of your choice. Choose one of three. Along with hundreds of similar miniature coffins, it is then boosted up and dumped out at an intermediate altitude, expeditiously avoiding both the crowded corridors of geosynchronous orbit and the disconcerting atmospheric drag of low Earth orbit. Instead, your ashes triumphantly circle the planet of your birth in the midst of the Van Allen radiation belts, a proton blizzard where no satellite in its right mind would risk going to in the first place. But ashes do not mind. At these heights, the Earth had become enveloped in the remains of its leading citizens, and an uninstructed visitor from a distant world might rightly believe he had chanced upon some somber space-age necropolis. The hazardous location of this mortuary would explain the absence of memorial visits from grieving relatives. S.R. Haddon, contemplating this image, had been appalled at what minor portions of immortality these deceased worthies had been willing to settle for. All their organic parts, brains, hearts, everything that distinguished them as a person, were atomized in their cremations. "There isn't any of you left after cremation," he thought, "just powdered bone. Hardly enough even for a very advanced civilization to reconstruct you from the remains. And then for good measure, your coffin is placed smack in the Van Allen belts, where even your ashes get slowly fried. How much better if a few of your cells could be preserved? Real living cells with the DNA intact." He visualized a corporation that would, for a healthy fee, freeze a little of your epithelial tissue and orbit it high, well above the Van Allen belts, maybe even higher than geosynchronous orbit. No reason to die first. Do it now, while it's on your mind. Then, at least alien molecular biologists, or their terrestrial counterparts of the far future, could reconstruct you, clone you, more or less from scratch. You would rub your eyes, stretch, and wake up in the year 10 million. Or even if nothing was done with your remains, there would still be in existence multiple copies of your genetic instructions. You would be alive in principle. In either case, it could be said that you would live forever. But as Haddon ruminated on the matter further, this scheme also seemed too modest, because that wasn't really you, a few cells scraped off the soles of your feet. At best, they could reconstruct your physical form, but that's not the same as you. If you were really serious, you should include family photographs, a punctiliously detailed autobiography, all the books and tapes you've enjoyed, and as much else about yourself as possible. Favorite brands of aftershave lotion, for example, or Diet Cola. It was supremely egotistical, he knew, and he loved it. After all, the age had produced a sustained eschatological delirium. It was natural to think of your own end as everyone else was contemplating the demise of the species, or the planet, or the massed celestial ascent of the elect. You couldn't expect the extraterrestrials to know English. If they're to reconstruct you, they'd have to know your language. So you must include a kind of translation, a problem Haddon enjoyed. It was almost the obverse of the message decryption problem. All of this required a substantial space capsule, so substantial that you need no longer be limited to mere tissue samples. You might as well send your body whole. If you could quick freeze yourself after death, so to say, there was a subsidiary advantage. Maybe enough of you would be in working order that whoever found you could do better than just reconstructing you. Maybe they could bring you back to life. Of course, after fixing whatever it was that you had died of. If you languished a little before freezing, though, because, say, the relatives had not realized you were dead yet, prospects for revival diminished. What would really make sense, he thought, was to freeze someone just before death. That would make eventual resuscitation much more likely, although there was probably limited demand for this service. But then why just before dying? Suppose you knew you had only a year or two to live. Wouldn't it be better to be frozen immediately, Haddon mused, before the meat goes bad? Even then, he sighed, no matter what the nature of the deteriorating illness, it might still be irremediable after you were revived. You would be frozen for a geological age, and then awakened, only to die promptly from a melanoma or a cardiac infarction about which the extraterrestrials might know nothing. No, he concluded, there was only one perfect realization of this idea. Someone in robust health would have to be launched on a one-way journey to the stars. As an incidental benefit, you would be spared the humiliation of disease and old age. Far from the inner solar system, your equilibrium temperature would fall to only a few degrees above absolute zero. No further refrigeration would be necessary, perpetual care provided, free. By this logic, he came to the final step of the argument. If it requires a few years to get to the interstellar cold, you might as well stay awake for the show, and get quick frozen only when you leave the solar system. It would also minimize overdependence on the cryogenics. Haddon had taken every reasonable precaution against an unexpected medical problem in Earth orbit, the official account went, even to preemptive sonic disintegration of his gall and kidney stones before he ever set foot in his chateau in the sky. And then he went and died of anaphylactic shock. A bee had buzzed angrily out of a bouquet of freesias sent up on Narnia by an admirer. Carelessly, Methuselah's capacious pharmacy had not stocked the appropriate anti-serum. The insect had probably been immobilized by the low temperatures in Narnia's cargo bay, and was not really to blame. Its small and broken body had been sent down for examination by forensic entomologists. The irony of the billionaire felled by a bee did not escape the notice of newspaper editorials and Sunday sermons. But in fact, this was all a deception. There had been no bee, no sting, and no death. Haddon remained in excellent health. Instead, on the stroke of the new year, 9 hours after the machine had been activated, the rocket engines flamed on a sizable auxiliary vehicle docked to Methuselah. It rapidly achieved escape velocity from the Earth-Moon system. He called it Gilgamesh. Haddon had spent his life amassing power and contemplating time. The more power you have, he found, the more you crave. Power and time were connected because all men are equal in death. That is why the ancient kings built monuments to themselves. But the monuments become eroded, the royal accomplishments obliterated, the very names of the kings forgotten. And, most important, they themselves were dead as doornails. No, this was more elegant, more beautiful, more satisfying. He had found a low door in the wall of time. Had he merely announced his plans to the world, certain complications would ensue. If Haddon was frozen to 4 degrees Kelvin at 10 billion kilometers from Earth, what exactly was his legal status? Who would control his corporations? This way was much tidier. In a minor codicil of an elaborate last will and testament, he had left his heirs and assigns a new corporation, skilled in rocket engines and cryogenics, that would eventually be called Immortality Incorporated. He need never think of the matter again. Gilgamesh was not equipped with a radio. He no longer wished to know what had happened to the five. He wanted no more news of Earth, nothing cheering, nothing to make him disconsolate, none of the pointless tumult he had known. Only solitude. Elevated thoughts. Silence. If anything adverse should occur in the next few years, Gilgamesh's cryogenics could be activated by the flip of a switch. Until then, there was a full library of his favorite music and literature and videotapes. He would not be lonely. He had never really been much for company. Yamagishi had considered coming, but ultimately reneged. He would be lost, he said, without staff. And on this journey, there were insufficient inducements, as well as inadequate space, for staff. The monotony of the food and the modest scale of the amenities might be daunting to some, but Haddon knew himself to be a man with a great dream. The amenities mattered not at all. In 2 years, this flying sarcophagus would fall into the gravitational potential well of Jupiter, just outside its radiation belt, be slingshot around the planet, and then flung off into interstellar space. For a day, he would have a view still more spectacular than that out the window of his study on Methuselah. The roiling, multicolored clouds of Jupiter, the largest planet. If it were only a matter of the view, Haddon would have opted for Saturn and the rings. He preferred the rings, but Saturn was at least 4 years from Earth, and that was, all things considered, taking a chance. If you're stalking immortality, you have to be very careful. At these speeds, it would take 10,000 years to travel even the distance to the nearest star. When you're frozen to 4 degrees above absolute zero, though, you have plenty of time. But some fine day, he was sure of it, though it be 1,000,000 years from now, Gilgamesh would by chance enter someone else's solar system, or his funeral bark would be intercepted in the darkness between the stars, and other beings, very advanced, very far-seeing, would take the sarcophagus aboard and know what had to be done. It had never really been attempted before. No one who ever lived on Earth had come this close. Confident that in his end would be his beginning, he closed his eyes and folded his arms experimentally across his chest, as the engines flared again, this time more briefly, and the burnished craft was sleekly set on its long journey to the stars. Thousands of years from now, God knows what would be happening on Earth, he thought. It was not his problem. It never really had been. But he would be asleep, deep frozen, perfectly preserved, his sarcophagus hurtling through the interstellar void, surpassing the pharaohs, besting Alexander, outshining Quinn. He had contrived his own resurrection. Chapter 23. Reprogramming. We have not followed cunningly devised fables, but were eyewitnesses. 2 Peter 1:16. Look and remember. Look upon this sky. Look deep and deep into the sea-clean air, the unconfined, the terminus of prayer. Speak now and speak into the hallowed dome. What do you hear? What does the sky reply? The heavens are taken. This is not your home. Carl J. Shapiro, Travelogue for Exiles. The telephone lines had been repaired, the roads plowed clean, and carefully selected representatives of the world's press were given a brief look at the facility. A few reporters and photographers were taken through the 3 matching apertures in the Benzels, through the airlock and into the dodec. There were television commentaries recorded, the reporters seated in the chairs that the 5 had occupied, telling the world of the failure of this first courageous attempt to activate the machine. Ellie and her colleagues were photographed from a distance to show that they were alive and well, but no interviews were to be given just yet. The machine project was taking stock and considering its future options. The tunnel from Honshu to Hokkaido was open again, but the passageway from Earth to Vega was closed. They hadn't actually tested this proposition. Ellie wondered whether when the 5 finally left the site, the project would try to spin up the Benzels again. But she believed what she had been told. The machine would not work again. There would be no further access to the tunnels for the beings of Earth. We could make little indentations in space-time as much as we liked. It would do us no good if no one hooked up from the other side. We had been given a glimpse, she thought, and then were left to save ourselves. If we could. In the end, the 5 were permitted to talk among themselves. She systematically bade farewell to each. No one blamed her for the blank cassettes. All these pictures on the cassettes are recorded in magnetic domains, on tape, Vega reminded her. A strong electrical field accumulated on the Benzels, and they were, of course, moving. A time-varying electrical field makes a magnetic field. Maxwell's equations. It seems to me that's how your tapes were erased. It was not your fault. Vege's interrogation had baffled him. They had not exactly accused him, but merely suggested that he was part of an anti-Soviet conspiracy involving scientists from the West. I tell you, Ellie, the only remaining open question is the existence of intelligent life in the Politburo. And the White House. I can't believe the president would allow Kitz to get away with this. She committed herself to the project. Oh, this planet is run by crazy people. Remember what they have to do to get where they are. Their perspective is so narrow, so brief. A few years, in the best of them, a few decades. They care only about the time they are in power. She thought about Cygnus A. But they are not sure our story is a lie. They cannot prove it. Therefore, we must convince them. In their hearts, they wonder, could it be true? A few even want it to be true, but it is a risky truth. They need something close to certainty. And perhaps we can provide it. We can refine gravitational theory. We can make new astronomical observations to confirm what we were told, especially for the galactic center and Cygnus A. They're not going to stop astronomical research. Also, we can study the Dodec if they give us access. Ellie, we will change their minds. Difficult to do if they're all crazy, she thought to herself. I don't see how the governments could convince people this is a hoax, she said. Oh, really? Think of what else they've made people believe. They've persuaded us that we'll be safe if only we spend all our wealth so everybody on Earth can be killed in a moment, when the governments decide the time has come. I would think it's hard to make people believe something so foolish. No, Ellie, they're good at convincing. They need only say that the machine doesn't work and that we've gone a little mad. I don't think we'd seem so mad if we all told our story together. Oh, but you may be right. Maybe we should try to find some evidence first. Vege, will you be okay when you, go back?
What can they do to me? Exile me to Gorky? I could survive that. I've had my day at the beach. No, I will be safe. You and I have a mutual security treaty, Ellie. As long as you're alive, they need me. And vice versa, of course. If the story is true, they will be glad there was a Soviet witness. Eventually, they will cry it from the rooftops. And like your people, they will wonder about military and economic uses of what we saw. It doesn't matter what they tell us to do. All that matters is that we stay alive. Then we will tell our story, all five of us. Discreetly, of course. At first, only to those we trust. But those people will tell others. The story will spread. There will be no way to stop it. Sooner or later, the governments will acknowledge what happened to us in the dodecahedron. And until then, we are insurance policies for each other. Ellie, I am very happy about all this. It is the greatest thing that ever happened to me.
Give Nina a kiss for me, she said just before he left on the night flight to Moscow. Over breakfast, she asked Xi if he was disappointed.
Disappointed? To go there?
He lifted his eyes skyward.
To see them and to be disappointed? I am an orphan of the Long March. I survived the Cultural Revolution. I was trying to grow potatoes and sugar beets for 6 years in the shadow of the Great Wall. Upheaval has been my whole life. I know disappointment. You have been to a banquet, and when you come home to your starving village, you are disappointed that they do not celebrate your return? Oh, this is no disappointment. We have lost a minor skirmish. Examine the disposition of forces.
He would shortly be departing for China, where he had agreed to make no public statements about what had happened in the machine. But he would return to supervise the dig at Xi'an. The tomb of Qin was waiting for him. He wanted to see how closely the Emperor resembled that simulation on the far side of the tunnels.
Forgive me.
I know this is impertinent, she said after a while. But the fact that of all of us, you alone met someone who... In all your life, wasn't there anyone you loved? She wished she had phrased the question better. Everyone I ever loved was taken from me. Obliterated. I saw the emperors of the 20th century come and go, he answered. I longed for someone who could not be revised, or rehabilitated, or edited out. There are only a few historical figures who cannot be erased. He was looking at the tabletop, fingering the teaspoon. I devoted my life to the revolution, and I have no regrets.
But I know almost nothing of my mother and father. I have no memories of them. Your mother is still alive. You remember your father and you found him again. Do not overlook how fortunate you are. In Davy, Ellie sensed a grief she had never before noticed. She assumed it was a reaction to the skepticism with which Project Directorate and the governments had greeted their story. But Davy shook her head.
Whether they believe us is not very important for me.
The experience itself is central. Transforming. Ellie, that really happened to us. It was real. The first night we were back here on Hokkaido, I dreamt that our experience was a dream, you know? But it wasn't. It wasn't. Yes, I'm sad. My sadness is... You know, I satisfied a lifelong wish up there when I found Surinder again after all these years. He was exactly as I remembered him, exactly as I've dreamed of him. But when I saw him, when I saw so perfect a simulation, I knew. This love was precious, because it had been snatched away, because I had given up so much to marry him. Nothing more. The man was a fool. 10 years with him and we would have been divorced. Maybe only 5. I was so young and foolish.
I'm truly sorry, Ellie said. I know a little about mourning a lost love.
Ellie, she replied, you don't understand. For the first time in my adult life, I do not mourn Surinder. What I mourn is the family I renounced for his sake.
Sukhavati was returning to Bombay for a few days, and then would visit her ancestral village in Tamil Nadu.
Eventually, she said, it will be easy to convince ourselves this was only an illusion. Every morning when we wake up, our experience will be more distant, more dreamlike.
It would have been better for us all to stay together, to reinforce our memories.
They understood this danger. That's why they took us to the seashore, something like our own planet, a reality we can grasp.
I will not permit anyone to trivialize this experience.
Remember, it really happened.
It was not a dream.
Ellie, don't forget.
Ada was, considering the circumstances, very relaxed. She soon understood why. While she and Vege had been undergoing lengthy interrogations, he had been calculating.
I think the tunnels are Einstein-Rosen bridges, he said. General relativity admits a class of solutions called wormholes, similar to black holes, but with no evolutionary connection. They cannot be generated as black holes can by the gravitational collapse of a star. But the usual sort of wormhole once made expands and contracts before anything can cross through. It exerts disastrous tidal forces and it also requires, at least as seen by an observer left behind, an infinite amount of time to get through.
Ellie did not see how this represented much progress and asked him to clarify. The key problem was holding the wormhole open. Ada had found a class of solutions to his field equations that suggested a new macroscopic field, a kind of tension that could be used to prevent a wormhole from contracting fully. Such a wormhole would pose none of the other problems of black holes. It would have much smaller tidal stresses, two-way access, quick transit times as measured by an exterior observer, and no devastating interior radiation field.
I don't know whether the tunnel is stable against small perturbations, he said. If not, they would have to build a very elaborate feedback system to monitor and correct the instabilities.
I'm not yet sure of any of this.
But at least if the tunnels can be Einstein-Rosen bridges, we can give some answer when they tell us we were hallucinating.
Ada was eager to return to Lagos, and she could see the green ticket of Nigerian Airlines peeking out of his jacket pocket. He wondered if he could completely work through the new physics their experience had implied. But he confessed himself unsure that he would be equal to the task, especially because of what he described as his advanced age for theoretical physics. He was 38. Most of all, he told Ellie, he was desperate to be reunited with his wife and children. She embraced Ada. She told him that she was proud to have known him.
Why the past tense?
He asked.
You will certainly see me again. And Ellie,
he added, almost as an afterthought.
Will you do something for me? Remember everything that happened. Every detail. Write it down. And send it to me. Our experience represents experimental data. One of us may have seen some point that the others missed. Something essential for a deep understanding of what happened. Send me what you write. I have asked the others to do the same.
He waved, lifted his battered briefcase, and was ushered into the waiting project car. They were departing for their separate nations, and it felt to Ellie as if her own family were being sundered, broken, dispersed. She, too, had found the experience transforming. How could she not? A demon had been exorcised. Several. And just when she felt more capable of love than she had ever been, she found herself alone. They spirited her out of the facility by helicopter. On the long flight to Washington in the government airplane, she slept so soundly that they had to shake her awake when the White House people came aboard, just after the aircraft landed briefly on an isolated runway at Hickam Field, Hawaii. They had made a bargain. She could go back to Argus, although no longer as director, and pursue any scientific problem she pleased. She had, if she liked, lifetime tenure. "We're not unreasonable," Kitts had finally said in agreeing to the compromise. "You come back with a solid piece of evidence, something really convincing, and we'll join you in making the announcement. We'll say we asked you to keep the story quiet until we could be absolutely sure. Within reason, we'll support any research you want to do. If we announce the story now, though, there'll be an initial wave of enthusiasm, and then the skeptics will start carping. It'll embarrass you, and it'll embarrass us. Much better to gather the evidence if you can."
Perhaps the president had helped him change his mind. It was unlikely Kitts was enjoying the compromise. But in return, she must say nothing about what had happened aboard the machine. The five had sat down in the dodecahedron, talked among themselves, and then walked off. If she breathed a word of anything else, the spurious psychiatric profile would find its way to the media, and reluctantly she would be dismissed. She wondered whether they had attempted to buy Peter Valerian's silence, or Vegas, or Abonema's. She couldn't see how, short of shooting the debriefing teams of five nations and the World Machine Consortium, they could hope to keep this quiet forever. It was only a matter of time. So, she concluded, they were buying time. It surprised her how mild the threatened punishments were, but violations of the agreement, if they happened, would not come on Kitts's watch. He was shortly retiring. In a year, the Lasker administration would be leaving office after the constitutionally mandated maximum of 2 terms. He had accepted a partnership in a Washington law firm known for its defense contractor clientele. Ellie thought Kitts would attempt something more. He seemed unworried about anything she might claim occurred at the Galactic Center. What he agonized about, she was sure, was the possibility that the tunnel was still open to, even if not from, the Earth. She thought the Hokkaido facility would soon be disassembled. The technicians would return to their industries and universities. What stories would they tell? Perhaps the dodecahedron would be displayed in the science city of Tsukuba. Then, after a decent interval when the world's attention was to some extent distracted by other matters, perhaps there would be an explosion at the machine site, nuclear, if Kitts could contrive a plausible explanation for the event. If it was a nuclear explosion, the radiological contamination would be an excellent reason to declare the whole area a forbidden zone. It would at least isolate the site from casual observers and might just shake the nozzle loose. Probably Japanese sensibilities about nuclear weapons, even if exploded underground, would force Kitts to settle for conventional explosives. They might disguise it as one of the continuing series of Hokkaido coal mine disasters. She doubted if any explosion, nuclear or conventional, could disengage the Earth from the tunnel. But perhaps Kitts was imagining none of these things. Perhaps she was selling him short. After all, he too must have been influenced by Machindo. He must have a family, friends, someone he loved. He must have caught at least a whiff of it. The next day, the president awarded her the National Medal of Freedom in a public ceremony at the White House.
Logs were burning in a fireplace set in a white marble wall. The president had committed a great deal of political, as well as the more usual sort of capital, to the machine project, and was determined to make the best face of it before the nation and the world. Investments in the machine by the United States and other nations, the argument went, had paid off handsomely. New technologies, new industries were blossoming, promising at least as much benefit for ordinary people as the inventions of Thomas Edison. We had discovered that we are not alone, that intelligences more advanced than we existed out there in space. They had changed forever, the president said, our conception of who we are. Speaking for herself, but also, she thought, for most Americans, the discovery had strengthened her belief in God, now revealed to be creating life and intelligence on many worlds, a conclusion that the president was sure would be in harmony with all religions. But the greatest good granted us by the machine, the president said, was the spirit it had brought to Earth, the increasing mutual understanding within the human community, the sense that we were all fellow passengers on a perilous journey in space and in time, the goal of a global unity of purpose that was now known all over the planet as Machindo. The president presented Ellie to the press and the television cameras, told of her perseverance over 12 long years, her genius in detecting and decoding the message, and her courage in going aboard the machine. No one knew what the machine would do. Dr. Arroway had willingly risked her life. It was not Dr. Arroway's fault that nothing happened when the machine was activated. She had done as much as any human possibly could. She deserved the thanks of all Americans and of all people everywhere on Earth. Ellie was a very private person. Despite her natural reticence, she had, when the need arose, shouldered the burden of explaining the message and the machine. Indeed, she had shown a patience with the press that she, the president, admired particularly. Dr. Arroway should now be permitted some real privacy, so she could resume her scientific career. There had been press announcements, briefings, interviews with Secretary Kitts and science advisor Derheer. The president hoped the press would respect Dr. Arroway's wish that there be no press conference. There was, however, a photo opportunity. Ellie left Washington without determining how much the president knew. They flew her back in a small, sleek jet of the Joint Military Airlift Command and agreed to stop in Janesville on the way. Her mother was wearing her old quilted robe. Someone had put a little color on her cheeks. Ellie pressed her face into the pillow beside her mother. Beyond regaining a halting power of speech, the old woman had recovered the use of her right arm sufficiently to give Ellie a few feeble pats on her shoulder. "Mom, I've got something to tell you. It's a great thing. But try to be calm. I don't want to upset you. Mom, I saw Dad. I saw him. He sends you his love." "Yes," the old woman slowly nodded. "Was here yesterday." John Stoughton, Ellie knew, had been to the nursing home the previous day. He had begged off accompanying Ellie today, pleading an excess of work, but it seemed possible that Stoughton merely did not wish to intrude on this moment. Nevertheless, she found herself saying with some irritation, No, I'm talking about Dad."
"Tell him."
The old woman's speech was labored.
"Tell him. Chiffon dress. Stop cleaners. Way home from store."
Her father evidently still ran the hardware store in her mother's universe. And Ellie's. The long sweep of cyclone fencing now stretched uselessly from horizon to horizon, blighting the expanse of scrub desert. She was glad to be back, glad to be setting up a new, although much smaller scale, research program. Jack Hibbert had been appointed acting director of the Argus facility, and she felt unburdened of the administrative responsibilities. Because so much telescope time had been freed when the signal from Vega had ceased, there was a heady air of progress in a dozen long-languishing subdisciplines of radio astronomy. Her co-workers offered not a hint of support for Kitts's notion of a message hoax. She wondered what Durhir and Valerian were telling their friends and colleagues about the message and the machine. Ellie doubted that Kitz had breathed a word of it outside the recesses of his soon-to-be-vacated Pentagon office. She had been there once. A Navy-enlisted man, sidearm in leather holster and hands clasped behind his back, had stiffly guarded the portal, in case, in the whirr of concentric hallways, some passerby should succumb to an irrational impulse. Willie had himself driven the Thunderbird from Wyoming, so it would be waiting for her. By agreement, she could drive it only on the facility, which was large enough for ordinary joyriding. But no more West Texas landscapes, no more Coney honor guards, no more mountain drives to glimpse a southern star. This was her sole regret about the seclusion. But the ranks of saluting rabbits were at any rate unavailable in winter. End of side 19.